A lot of what I'm going to talk about today comes from an article I wrote a few years ago entitled, appropriately enough, A Constitutional Right to Preschool. While I was working on this article, I would talk to colleagues in the law school and outside, including this student who Bob and I both know, and tell them, I was learning all this stuff about preschool and working on this paper, or yada, yada, yada. And they would all say to a person, well, if you want to talk to someone who actually knows something about preschool, you should talk to Bob Pianta. And I thought, what that statement implied made me very impressed by Bob and a little bit depressed about myself. So it's good to finally meet him. I think it's fair to say that access to preschool today, aside from perhaps the No Child Left Behind Act, is one of the hottest issues in education law and policy. In 1980, there were only 10 state-sponsored programs. Today, publicly funded programs exist in 40 states and the District of Columbia, and these programs complement the well-known federal Head Start program. Spending has increased accordingly from about $190 million in 1988 to well over $2.5 billion today. And today, enrollment in state-sponsored programs is about the same as it is in the federal Head Start program. About half of all 3- and 4-year-olds attend preschool, whether public or private. Half of this group are in public preschools, publicly funded preschools. Half are in private. If you're math challenged like me, that means 25% of all 3- and 4-year-olds are in preschool, private preschool. 25% are in public, and about half are in neither. Those who are not in preschool number in the millions and tend to be from poorer and less educated families. Support for increased access to preschool is both substantial and diverse. Groups from across the political spectrum champion the cause, including, among others, teachers' unions, business associations, anti-crime groups, philanthropic foundations, and even a couple of analysts from the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis. Until recently, the question of whether to increase access to preschool was predominantly, if not exclusively, a political question, meaning that it was debated in legislative arenas. But as de Tocqueville pointed out nearly a century and a half ago, in this country, nearly all political issues eventually become legal ones. This observation is now trite, but only because of its consistent confirmation. We in the law school world, of course, are delighted by this fact, as it makes all of our graduates fully employed upon graduation. Preschool is proving to be no exception to the pattern that de Tocqueville observed, and a pattern that's been confirmed ever since. Before 1997, there were no court decisions on the issue. Since that time, 4 state Supreme Courts have weighed in on the question, and litigation on the issue is pending in 10 states: Arkansas, Arizona, Colorado, Connecticut, Georgia, Indiana, Kentucky, South Dakota, Wyoming, and Nebraska. And in fact, it's pending twice in Nebraska, as there are 2 different suits in that state. Virginia is not on this list, not yet, anyway. More on that in a minute. The litigation in most places is still in its infancy, and it's too early, really, to discern any kind of pattern. I'll talk more about that later. In the course of my remarks, what I want to address are really 2 questions. The first is whether access to preschool ought to be expanded, and the second is whether there's a role for state courts to play in the expansion of access. For those of you who like suspense, cover your ears. For those of you who can't stand suspense, I'll tell you now that my answers are generally yes, that it ought to be expanded, and yes, that state courts can play a role. What I want to do is start by giving you some brief facts about preschool, including an overview of existing programs and some of the social science data, then lay out the legal claims, describe how they've fared so far, and then end with a discussion of a difficult question about whether this is the sort of issue that courts should be taking on. Just by show of hands, how many of you have a legal background? Okay, and how many of you have a social science background? Okay, so I think the first part of this talk will bore you to tears, and the second part will bewilder you. So you have something to look forward to. Okay, so start with the programs that exist. Although the growth in programs has been fairly dramatic, and support for increased access exists, Most states are still a long way from offering universal access to preschool, either just to four-year-olds or to both 3- and 4-year-olds. Most states, just like the federal government does with regard to Head Start, limit eligibility to poor kids, and even then don't serve all poor or disadvantaged kids who are eligible. There are some exceptions. Georgia, of all states, provides universal access. Oklahoma makes money available to any district that wishes to provide preschool. New York and West Virginia have passed legislation that calls for implementing universal preschool. And thanks to a ballot initiative, this hasn't received a lot of attention, but it's an interesting development. A ballot initiative in Florida has made that state the very first state in the country where four-year-olds have an explicit constitutional right to preschool. In Virginia, as many of you know, the Virginia Preschool Initiative provides funding to school districts that are willing to sponsor preschool programs for at-risk 4-year-old kids. The state and locality share the expense. Children who are receiving free lunch or who are otherwise at risk and who aren't served by Head Start are eligible for the program. There are about, Tom and Kathy would know this better than I do, but I think there are about 19,000 4-year-olds who are eligible, and about 65% of those are served. Participation by students and by local districts is voluntary. The eligibility requirements are somewhat complicated, and there's some controversy about them. About $5,700 per pupil is spent on average. The universe of preschool programs, and now I'm just talking about publicly funded preschool programs that are sponsored by states, is complicated and chaotic. There's nothing close to the system of K-12 schools that we're all familiar with. Among some of the notable differences, the federal government spends much more than the states and localities combined on preschool. The federal government spends about 3 times as much as states and localities on preschool, which is much different from the K-12 arena where states and localities make up the bulk of the funding. Another interesting difference is that public programs are just as likely to be provided through private service providers than they are through public schools, which I was talking to Tom about this just before I began my talk, which is really interesting if you think about the voucher debate and the voucher wars. One of the things that's gone under the radar screen for the most part in the voucher wars is that we have a long-standing experiment, in fact, with vouchers through preschool programs, which are offered by private providers, including churches. And one of the oddities, to me anyway, about the teachers' union's support for expanding access to preschool is they're not insisting that it be provided in public schools, at least not yet. Funding for preschool varies from state to state, but in general, states spend far less on preschool education than they do on K-12 education. In 2001 and 2, for example, the average amount spent on preschool by states was about $3,500 per pupil. The average amount per pupil in K-12 was about $8,700. The federal government, through the Head Start program, spends on average about $7,000. That figure is a little bit inflated because Head Start includes health and nutritional services, but it's notable that there are only 2 states that spend more than the federal government, New Jersey and Oregon. In Virginia, the average spent on preschool the average spent on the K-12 student is about 1.5 times that spent on the preschool student. Just as funding varies, quality varies as well, as you might imagine, and this is an area where Bob is expert. It varies along various dimensions, including whether there are curricular standards, what sort of teacher degree requirements or certification requirements there are, class size requirements, and teacher-child ratios. There's also a debate, as Bob well knows, about which are relevant proxies for quality and which are not. But suffice it to say, at a general matter, that quality obviously matters, and that the higher quality of the program, the more benefits there are going to be, although oftentimes that ends up just being circular reasoning, that you know that a program is high quality because there are benefits from it. which leads to the social science evidence. There are people in this room who know a heck of a lot more about this than I do. I am not an expert on the social science evidence and don't pretend to be one. I'm a consumer of it. And so what I thought I'd do is just let you know what I see in the studies, but I'll direct any and all questions about this to Bob if you have them afterwards. Studies of the effects of preschool are legion. Head Start has been the subject of over 600 studies, and there have been plenty of studies of other programs, both public and private. Some of these studies are of large-scale programs that weren't designed as models. So they're studies of Head Start programs, or there's a famous study of the preschool programs in Chicago, the Chicago Child Parent Centers. Other studies are of model programs, programs that were created as research models to assess the effects of preschool. And the most famous are the Perry Preschool Project in Michigan and then the Abecedarian Project in North Carolina. Not all the studies are reliable, and indeed a number of them suffer from various methodological flaws. One of the biggest weaknesses in a lot of the studies, as you can imagine, is the lack of a randomized control group. For some reason, parents aren't wild about letting their kids be given essentially an educational placebo. So you don't get that many randomized experiments. Despite the weaknesses, there is a consensus, I think, on at least a couple of key points. First, there's typically a gap in school readiness between poor and affluent kids, or disadvantaged and middle-class kids when they enter kindergarten. And children who begin behind in school rarely catch up. If anything, they tend to fall further behind. This is obviously a problem, it always has been, but it's an increasingly important one in the age of test-based accountability, where there's such an emphasis on performing at grade level. That's harder to do if you start school basically behind and have a harder time catching up. So the gap that exists at the very beginning of school is obvious, and the need to do something about it is increasingly acute. Second, studies suggest that quality preschools for disadvantaged kids help close the gap in school readiness. In addition, researchers have found that these programs can have long-term positive effects on academic achievement, and that participation in the programs can also reduce grade retention rates, demand for special education services, and can increase graduation rates and employment prospects, and in some studies they found a decrease in crime rates. Now, when I first read this, I thought, how can that be? It's not the case that four-year-olds who aren't in preschool are out robbing convenience stores. That's not where the decrease in crime rates comes from. Basically, the idea is that if kids get off on the right track, they will continue to have success throughout their school years. And if they don't and start out behind, they'll be on a very different track. So that's basically the theory. Kids who are offered preschool start out ready for school and continue to experience success, whereas those who don't start out behind the eight ball and often don't get out behind it. Now, not all preschool programs obviously provide the same level of benefits. And in general, I think it's fair to say that the more intensive the program, the more benefits there are, which leads to the inevitable scaling up question. So a common criticism of the Perry Preschool Project, for example, or the Abecedarian Project is, well, that's great. The model program is going to work, but you're never going to be able to scale that up. As far as I can tell, the concern about scaling up is a little bit exaggerated. To begin, the beneficial effects from preschool are not just found in studies of model programs. There was a recent study of the Chicago Child Parent Center as a longitudinal study that indicated that program, which was not a model program and not a terribly expensive program, had some pretty significant effects, including lowering the rates of grade retention and placement in special education, higher rates of graduation, and lower rates of juvenile arrest. In addition, and this doesn't get pointed out that often, even the model programs, Perry Preschool and Abecedarian, were not wildly expensive. The amount spent per child was not much more than the amount spent per K through 12 student. So I think it's fair to say that it's possible and plausible, I should say, to create a quality preschool program without breaking the bank. It's not to say that creating a quality preschool program can be done on the cheap, but it's not exorbitantly expensive. I think it's fair to say that if you spent about the same amount you spent on the average K through 12 student, you could create a quality preschool, and I'm delighted that Bob is nodding his head in agreement. The other thing to recognize about creating a quality preschool program is that it will likely save the government more money in the long run than the government spends. In other words, preschool is a decent investment, which is exactly why you have people from the Federal Reserve Bank saying, yeah, we ought to invest in preschool. It's a much wiser investment than, say, investing in a sports stadium, the JPJ Arena, notwithstanding, which I love, just to be on the record in case anyone's, oh, this is being recorded. Yeah, I think it was a great idea to build that arena. How much the government will ultimately save obviously varies on the particular study and turns on things like the discount rate and what costs are included and what savings are included. But I think one of the reasons why preschool is so popular these days is that social scientists have been really savvy in presenting findings about preschool, and they've made an effort to monetize the costs and benefits. And so if you listen to politicians who are in favor of expanding access to preschool, they will often cite these studies, including our own Governor Kane, who will make the point that, look, an investment in preschool brings returns that more than make up for the cost of it. So, you know, you'll see studies of the Perry Preschool Project for the Chicago Child Parent Centers, where researchers will conclude that for every dollar invested, the government will save or recoup $3, both in terms of reduced education costs in the short term, right? So if kids don't go into special education programs as a result of being in a preschool program, that saves the school system money. And then even over the long term, if they're more likely to graduate from high school as a result, they're more likely to earn more money, which is then going to result in less welfare dependency and greater tax revenues. You see the point, right? So to answer the first question, should access to publicly funded preschools be expanded? I think the answer is pretty clearly sure, at least for poor four-year-olds. That is to say, as I read the social science evidence, the benefits for poor kids are the clearest, and it is not so clear that you need to start at three rather than four, which then brings up the issue of targeting, which is a pretty controversial and difficult issue. And it really is there are really two separate questions. The first is whether preschool should be targeted just to disadvantaged kids. I'm saying poor, but you could use other criteria from a single family home, from English as a second language. I'll just use just poor as a marker for the various ways you could define disadvantage. That's one question. The other question is, should it start at four or should it start at three? As far as I can tell, the social science evidence is a little bit mixed on both questions. There's no doubt that all kids can benefit from preschool, but it seems that poor kids benefit more than middle-class kids. That is, if you look at the benefits given to middle-class kids, the bump is not as great as it would be for poor kids. Same with 3 and 4-year-olds. There are some studies that suggest that if you start at 3, the kids will be even better off than you start at 4, but other studies say, no, and actually if you have a high-quality program that starts at 4, you'll actually be just fine. All of which is to say not that, well, you should definitely start at 4 and definitely only target poor kids. Not at all. It's just to say that that's where you can make the clearest case that the benefits to publicly funded preschool outweigh the cost. With regard to the other groups, it's a slightly harder case to make, which means that, you know, it will turn on things like overall cost, political support, and perhaps, to the extent this is decided by courts, the legal theory that's used to advance the claim. Which leads to the second question about the legal basis. So I'll talk and then leave time for questions at the end. Is that okay? All right. So all claims that have been brought for increased access to preschool have been brought in state courts, and the claims have been based on state constitutions. Before explaining the gist of such claims, it might make sense to say a word about the federal constitution. Now, in the law school, we teach mostly by the Socratic method, so I can't go through an entire lecture without asking you a question. So I wonder if anyone knows why a claim for access to preschool under the federal constitution is more or less a non-starter.
Okay. Rodriguez?
Oh, yeah, that's even better. Okay, but start something more basic. Who thinks that is there a right to education in the federal constitution?
No.
Yes.
The right reserved to the states. I mean, it's a responsibility reserved to the states.
Traditionally, it is, although the No Child Left Behind Act calls that into question. But there is no right to education, and we're going to get to Rodriguez. That's a really good answer. The federal constitution says nothing about education. This doesn't mean that the court couldn't recognize the right to education. The federal constitution also says nothing about the right to privacy, but the court has recognized the right to privacy. And the court in Brown versus Board of Education seemed to at least nod in the direction of recognizing a right to education when it said education is so important that where the state has undertaken to provide it, education is a right which must be made available to all on equal terms, which seems to recognize a right to equal educational opportunity, but unfortunately it turns out that the court didn't really mean it. And it made this clear in the case of San Antonio versus Rodriguez, which was decided in 1973. In that case, the court rejected the idea that education is a fundamental right and held that it was constitutional for a state to fund schools unequally. The court upheld Texas's unequal system of school funding. This isn't all that surprising that the court wouldn't recognize a fundamental right to education, in part because the federal constitution is typically considered to be a document that protects negative liberties rather than protects affirmative rights. And to give a perfect illustration of this, in the same year that the court decided that there is not a fundamental right to education, 1973, does anyone know what the court did recognize there is a fundamental right to?
Abortion.
Rodriguez is decided in the same year as Roe versus Wade, which always confuses my constitutional law students, because you have the court saying in Rodriguez, we just don't make up fundamental rights, except for maybe this one. Over here, the way to understand the difference is that the fundamental right to abortion doesn't guarantee you access to abortion. It says that the government can't prohibit you from receiving one, right? Whereas if you're talking about education, you're talking about the federal government or the state governments actually having to provide you something. And so you can see this actually in later cases where the court says it's perfectly fine for state and federal governments not to provide funding for poor women who want to obtain an abortion. That's okay for the federal government to say, we'll give you funding if you have your child, but we won't give you funding if you obtain an abortion. Same idea, the government doesn't protect an affirmative right. Okay, if there's no right to education, you're not going to really get off the ground by arguing that there's a right to preschool. So litigants, not surprisingly, have turned to state constitutions. All state constitutions have what are known as education clauses. The precise wording of these clauses varies, but they generally require states to create a system of free public schools. And this obligation on the legislature in turn creates the right to education. Some constitutions require legislatures to create a general and uniform system of public schools. Others require legislatures to create a thorough and efficient system of public schools. And some others use one or more combinations of these phrases. The Virginia Constitution requires the creation of, quote, a system of free public elementary and secondary schools for all children of school age throughout the Commonwealth. Now, most, if not all, state constitutions also contain provisions that guarantee the equal protection of the law. And it's the combination of these clauses that can provide a basis for a claim of access to preschool. So let me start at the very beginning. The place to start anytime you're going to interpret a constitution really is with the text of the constitution itself, and a typical move, if the text is not that clear, is to consult the history to try to get some idea of what the words were meant to do or what those who were around at the time understood them to do. You might think, and this is what I thought at first when I first started looking into this, that constitutions, state constitutions, would answer the question about access to preschool by specifying age limits in the Constitution, by saying that the right to education begins at age 4, age 5, or that the legislature has to create a public school system that begins for kindergartners or kids who are age 5. It turns out, I think somewhat oddly, that most state constitutions are completely silent on this issue. Only 7 specify age limits. 5 of these indicate that children have to be 5 years or older. 2 explicitly extend the right to 4-year-olds. And as proof that courts are not always bound by plain language in state constitutions, the Supreme Court of New Jersey has recognized a right to preschool, even though New Jersey is one of the 5 states that says you don't have a right to education until you're 5. And Wisconsin has rejected the idea that there is some right to preschool, even though Wisconsin's constitution is one of the 2 that says you have a right to education when you're in at 4. So even though I think you ought to begin with the language of the Constitution, it's important to recognize that courts don't always end with the language of the Constitution. Now, a few other state constitutions suggest that education begins in kindergarten, while others suggest, which just can't be true, but the language suggests that the right to education begins at birth. Louisiana, for example, protects the right to education at all stages of human development. That just can't be right. I mean, it's not, there's no way Louisiana Supreme Court is going to rule on behalf of 2-year-olds and 80-year-olds for a right to education. Virginia, if you recall the language I read, nicely straddles the line by requiring education to be available to all children of school age, without saying what school age is. Which leads to the next point. Now, you might think that even where constitutions are silent about this, it's got to be the case that legislatures have the duty and the authority to decide the age when education begins. I think that this is a reasonable first step, but it can't be the final answer. That is, it cannot be right that legislatures have unfettered discretion to determine age eligibility for education. Imagine, for example, that a state decided tomorrow that only 8 to 10-year-olds would be entitled to education, that the right to education begins at 8 years old and it ends at 10 years old. I don't think any court in the country would say that, sure, a legislature has the ability to do that. That is to say, in other words, that the very right to education contains some implicit guarantee of the right to at least a minimally adequate education. If legislatures could monkey around with age eligibility requirements without any oversight, they would have the ability to make a mockery of the right to education, which in turn suggests that there must be some limit, some outer limit on the legislature's discretion, some external principle that limits the legislature's discretion, that's tied either to what we think constitutes an adequate education or is tied to some notions of equality, which turn out to be the basis for a claim to preschool. In fact, you might even flip the argument about age eligibility on its head, and if you're an advocate for increasing access to preschool, use it against states by saying something along the lines of, legislatures have already decided that school begins at age 4. After all, what else would you call preschool but the beginning of school, right? If states have already decided, like Virginia through the Virginia Preschool Initiative, that some 4-year-olds get to go to public schools in the morning and spend 3 or 4 hours in a classroom, what else do you call that? It's not housing. It's not food. It's school. And if they've done this, Haven't they already decided that their public school system begins at age 4, right? And if that's the case, the question for courts is no longer, well, can courts override the legislature's decision about when school begins? The question, the real question is, well, can legislatures decide that school begins at age 4 and then only provide it to some 4-year-olds but not others? Which is a harder question if you're a legislature to answer, right? Now, I don't think that courts are going to be inclined to play this sort of gotcha game. I don't think that this argument would win, in other words. I think it's a decent point to make, but I don't think a court would say, oh, well, look, you started this, you need to finish it. But the more important point to make is that I don't think a court would say on the other extreme that, well, a legislature just gets to decide this. We have no business saying anything about this. All of which is to say that I think you have to get to the merits of the argument as to whether there is some good reason that access to preschool ought to be expanded. Now, the text doesn't tell you much. The next place to look is history, but history doesn't tell you anything, really. The history about the drafting of the education clauses is pretty sparse. There's not much discussion at all about when education ought to begin. If you ask those who were involved in the drafting, should education begin at preschool, they would have looked at you like you were crazy because they never would have heard of preschool. So you can't say that it's illogical to say that, well, you know, the history shows that the right to education shouldn't extend to preschoolers because preschool just didn't exist when most of these education clauses were provided. To give you an example of this, the federal constitution says that the president is commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy. No one doubts that the president is also the commander-in-chief of the Air Force. Yet if you ask the framers of the constitution, do you think the president is the commander-in-chief of the Air Force? They would have looked at you like, well, no, because I don't know what an Air Force is. Why? Because planes didn't exist when that provision in the constitution was enacted, right? So that kind of inquiry just ends up leading you nowhere. And in some ways, it's the wrong question to ask. But if you think that, well, the way to decide what history shows about constitutional provisions is to imagine a conversation with those who were alive at the time, the right question to ask would not be, do you think it begins at preschool, but rather, do you think that the right to education ought to change as the need for education changes? And my guess is that once you ask the question that way, it becomes much more plausible to imagine that, sure, those alive at the time would have imagined that the right to school would change as the need for education changes. Again, it's not a knocked out argument in favor of a right to preschool, but it is a rebuttal, I think, effective of the idea that history precludes recognizing a right to preschool. So where does that leave you? Text is inconclusive, history is inconclusive. Well, the place to turn is to precedent. And here is where it gets pretty interesting. The relevant precedents for claims to preschool are school finance decisions. Advocates in nearly every state have relied on education clauses, either alone or in combination with equal protection provisions in state constitutions, to challenge school funding systems. Challenges have been based either on the inequity of the system or the inadequacy of the system. Challenges have been brought in almost every state, and they've been successful in about 20. And in some states, one theory has been rejected, but another one has been left open. So Virginia is a good example. In 1994, the Virginia Supreme Court rejected a challenge to Virginia's school funding system, which argued that students in Virginia were entitled to equal funding. And the Supreme Court said that, well, we think education is a fundamental right under our Constitution, but there is no fundamental right to equal funding. But the court left the door open for a claim that the funding was inadequate, or at least that's how some have read the opinion. And that has happened in other states, where courts have rejected a claim for equal funding, but left open the idea that there might be a claim for inadequacy. Now, the key point to recognize in these cases is that although they all revolve around money, That is really properly considered the remedy. The right that's recognized in these cases is either the right to equal educational opportunity or the right to an adequate education. And claims to preschool would rest on the recognition of these rights, or in states where courts haven't yet recognized a right to an adequate education, they would argue, for example, that preschool is part of the right to an adequate education. There are really four different claims that could be made. Some of these have already been made in cases. One or two haven't been, but easily could. And let me explain them briefly. There are two under an equity theory and two under an adequacy theory. And basically, they just differ in so far as whether you'd be arguing for universal access or for more targeted access. An equity claim would be fairly straightforward. The argument would be, and you've seen this already in some cases, that education is a fundamental right, and so any inequality with regard to the provision of education can't be tolerated absent some compelling reason. A lack of funds generally is not considered a compelling reason in and of itself. So in states that provide preschool to some children but not to others, an equity-based claim would challenge this discrepancy. Right? It would argue, well, you can't provide preschool to some four-year-olds but not others unless you've got a really compelling reason. The argument would be that education is too important to provide to one set of children as opposed to another. Again, imagine if the state said, okay, next year, because of a budget crunch, we're going to provide fifth grade to some kids, but we're not going to provide it to others. That's the argument that you would make. You just can't make those distinctions in the context of education. Now, this theory could support a claim for universal access or a more targeted claim, which is why I say there are two different approaches based on an equity theory. You might argue that equality demands universal access, given that preschool has benefits for all kids and that there's not a good enough reason to distinguish between some four-year-old kids. Or you could argue, in contrast, that, well, you can imagine a rational reason, and maybe even a very good reason, to distinguish between poor or disadvantaged kids and others, that those kids are differently situated when it comes to the benefits that preschool will provide and when it comes to the ability to pay for preschool. So that a state could, in theory, draw a line between middle-class kids and poor kids. But what a state couldn't do is say, well, having drawn that line, we're only going to provide preschool to some poor kids, right? There's no way you could justify that distinction. You might be able to justify a distinction between poor kids, broadly defined, and non-poor kids, but you wouldn't be able to say that, yeah, well, some poor kids, but not other poor kids, right? So if you follow that targeted approach, what you would be after is a program that guaranteed access to all poor kids, who fit the criteria. That's one set of claims. The other set of claims would rest on the idea that there is a right to an adequate education, and adequacy claims in the school finance context usually involve two conceptual steps. The first is that the court has to decide what constitutes an adequate education, what are the goals of an adequate education, and then ostensibly work backwards from that in the second step to figure out, well, what are the inputs that are necessary in order to achieve the goals that constitute an adequate education. Well, a claim to preschool would make the argument fairly straightforward that, look, most of the goals that you would consider part and parcel of an adequate education, the ability to advance from one grade to the next in the regular education program, the ability to graduate on time, the ability to pass tests, will all be helped by preschool. So that preschool is one of those inputs that ought to count when you're trying to figure out what does a state have to provide in order to give all students a decent opportunity for obtaining an adequate education. Does everyone follow that? Now you might think, wow, that seems really radical that courts would be doing that. And some people have that view, and it's a reasonable view that this is not something courts ought to be doing at all. One thing you ought to realize, though, is that courts are already doing this. They're already doing this in the context of school funding suits, right? So if you start from that basis, the idea that courts should then decide whether preschool ought to count as one of those inputs doesn't seem as radical when the baseline is, well, courts are already deciding, okay, well, do we need to require smaller class sizes in order to guarantee the right to an adequate education? And if so, how much is that going to cost? Now, you could narrow this claim as well by arguing that instead of arguing that, well, preschool ought to be provided universally because it is part and parcel of an adequate education, you could argue that the better way to think about preschool is as preparation for an adequate education. And this idea builds on the widespread notion that kids from disadvantaged families, poor kids again, require greater resources in order to stay level with their middle class counterparts, right? You see this notion all across the world of law and policy, right? Title I is originally based on the idea that poor kids need extra assistance. Nearly every state school funding system is based on the idea that poor kids need extra assistance, and at least in theory, states provide more money to schools that have poor kids. So one way to argue in favor of preschool is to say, look, in order to ensure that kids, poor kids, are ready to start kindergarten, at least poor kids ought to be provided preschool, because it's been demonstrated that providing preschool makes them more ready to begin kindergarten. A couple of state Supreme Courts, North Carolina and New Jersey, have both gone down this road. New Jersey rests its embrace of a right to preschool on the idea that poor kids need this in order to prepare them for schools. North Carolina Supreme Court recognized this idea in general, but wasn't quite ready to order the state to provide it. Notice that to the extent courts pursue this theory, or advocates pursue this theory, the issue of age eligibility becomes a red herring, because you're no longer talking about when public school begins. You can accept that public school begins in kindergarten, but insist that the right to education, in order to be made meaningful, requires that for poor kids, they be given preschool, right? And this is exactly how the North Carolina court analyzed it when presented with it. North Carolina court said, look, we think the legislature does have the ability to say when school begins, but that's neither here nor there. The real issue is whether you need to provide some extra assistance to four-year-olds in order to prepare them to take advantage of the right that we all agree exists and that the legislature says begins at age 5, right? Not that different from requiring additional services for poor kids, like extra counseling or tutoring services that courts have provided in the context of adequacy suits. Now, which of these theories to pursue obviously depends on which state you're in. And if you're in a state that has recognized the right to adequate education, then you've got a decent basis for arguing that preschool ought to be considered part of it. If you're in a state that has recognized the right to equal educational opportunity, well, that suggests you ought to style your claim that way. I'm talking in terms of whether you'd want to do this. If you're in a state that has, like Virginia, that has rejected an equity claim but has left open an adequacy claim, well, then you've got to, you know, kill two birds with one stone. Argue that there is a right to adequacy and that it includes preschool. So that's a basic sketch of the arguments. Let me talk a little bit about what courts have done and then at least peek down the road of whether this is something courts should be doing at all. So far, I think it's fair to say there's neither a juggernaut in favor of recognizing right to preschool nor a clear pattern rejecting it. New Jersey, as I've said, recognizes a right to preschool for disadvantaged 3- and 4-year-olds. It's a more complicated story than this. It's been part of the court's never-ending school funding decisions, the result of which is that 3- and 4-year-olds in poor urban districts are entitled to preschool. At the other end of the spectrum, the Arkansas Supreme Court rejected a claim to preschool resting on a specific provision in their state constitution, which is unique, that gives the legislature essentially unfettered discretion about whether to fund education below the age of 6. It's an odd provision, but it's pretty clear. And the Arkansas court quite rightly relied on it. The Arkansas court though, went beyond that and said, and we also think that this is just a question that the legislature ought to resolve, and I'll come back to that in a second. In between our North Carolina and Massachusetts, the Supreme Courts in those states rejected claims for preschool but didn't foreclose them altogether. As I've suggested, both states acknowledged that poor kids need additional assistance and that preschool might be one means of providing this additional assistance, but neither state Supreme Court was willing at that point in time to say preschool is the only service or the service that the legislature has to provide, and instead gave the legislature some time to figure out whether preschool is indeed the service that they want to provide in order to enhance school readiness. So I would stay tuned in those states. In terms of trial court decisions, it's interesting to note that the Arkansas, North Carolina, and Massachusetts Supreme Courts all overturned trial courts who had recognized the right to preschool, indicating that there are indeed courts ready to recognize this right. And as I mentioned, there are 11 suits pending in 10 states. It's too early to tell how this will play out, but it's pretty clear that school finance advocates are all these days, including a claim for preschool, when they challenge the adequacy or equity of funding. It's just, with no exception, this is included in every new case. Although it's too early, I think, to predict how this is going to come out, it's not too early to think about the larger question, and it's a difficult one, of whether this is something that courts ought to be taking on. So let me just say a couple of words about this, and then I'll open up for questions. I think to make progress on this question, it's important to brush aside what is not the right question. And by this I mean, it's common for people to say with an issue like this that, oh, you know, courts just shouldn't decide this because it would be too activist for courts to be deciding this. This is just something that legislatures should decide. And the charge of activism is routinely made by politicians and by advocates. And I find the charge largely meaningless because if you poke hard and long enough, what you discover is that the charge of activism results really means nothing more than I disagree with what the court has done. Well, the technically correct legal response to that argument is la-di-da. Who cares if you don't agree with what the court has done? The question you really want to ask is, well, would it be illegitimate for the court to recognize a right to preschool? And here, you might make that charge, but I think the charge would be false. State constitutions guarantee a right to education. There's no doubt about it. They guarantee a right to education. They're not clear about what the scope of that right is. Well, courts exist to interpret constitutional provisions, among other things, even constitutional provisions that aren't entirely clear. You might think that in a particular case, the court should not recognize the right to preschool. Completely reasonable people might reach that conclusion. But it's wrong to say that a court would be acting illegitimately if it reached the opposite conclusion. There are plausible arguments based on precedent, very plausible arguments, for reaching the opposite conclusion, that there is a right to preschool, right? So you should brush aside the idea that somehow this is obviously an issue that ought to be left to the legislature, because that's assuming the answer to the question, right? You need to address both text, history, and then precedent to decide whether this is a question that ought to be left to the legislature. Now, you still might think that even if there's a plausible legal basis for recognizing a right to preschool, that courts shouldn't get involved, that faced with this indeterminacy, courts should stay their hands. What I think you'd want to think about here is, well, are courts competent to make these decisions? And is a court decision likely to be effective? Right? Think about the first question. Are courts competent to make this decision? Well, the answer, unfortunately, as is true elsewhere in law and life, is it depends. The question is relative, right? No one would deny that all else equal, this is much better for legislatures to decide. There are a lot of difficult questions. When should it begin? How do you combine a state program with the federal Head Start program? Where should preschool be provided? In public schools, or should it be provided with the partnership of private service providers? All those are difficult questions that are going to be hard for courts to answer. But suppose you don't trust the legislature, right? Suppose the legislature isn't doing anything, or suppose the legislature is monkeying around with eligibility requirements, right? And suggesting that all poor kids are eligible, but then it turns out that when you look closely, they're not. Or suppose legislatures aren't doing anything. Or suppose legislatures want to fund it one year but not the next. Then you might say, well, gosh, I think it would be better for courts to be involved. Right? All else equal, legislatures are better, but when legislatures aren't doing something, or when legislatures are doing one thing one year and something another year, it might be better, all things considered, for courts to recognize a right of access. That is, create an entitlement to preschool rather than have preschool be subject to legislative grace. The last question is whether a court decision would be effective. Would it stick? Well, you know, there's a trend in law schools, which is a little bit peculiar, given that we're training lawyers, but there is a trend among legal academics to suggest that courts are powerless to affect social change, right? The pendulum has swung back from the heady days of the Warren Court, where everyone believed that the Supreme Court could snap its fingers and the world would change, to now everyone believes that no matter what you do as a court, nothing is going to happen. Well, I think the notion of court ineffectiveness is wrong in the preschool context, primarily because preschool is popular. One of the ironic things about courts is that they're best pushing at open, slightly open doors. And that's, I think, what's happening with preschool, right? You're not going to get a backlash if a court recognizes a right of access to preschool the way you get a backlash when a court recognizes a right to abortion or gay rights. Everyone loves preschool these days, right? You can't publicly say, if you're a politician, screw the four-year-olds. You know, I could care less, right? You say, I love preschool, right? So there's not going to be that kind of back. There's going to be a fight about funding and cuts in other programs, but not the same kind of movement against preschool. Then you think about the groups that are in favor of it. You've got business groups, you've got teachers' unions, you've got preschool providers, all of whom are going to be interested in making sure that the decision sticks. Well, under those circumstances, I think there's reason to believe that a court decision would be quite effective. In fact, a court decision might help provide cover for those in the legislature or in the governor's office who are interested in providing greater access to preschool, but can't convince their colleagues or are worried about political ramifications. You've got a court decision that then legislatures can say, the court's saying we have to do this. And that's exactly what's happened in the school finance arena. The most effective school finance decisions have happened in states where legislatures were already poised to revise the school finance formula, but were a little worried about what might happen. And then the court came along and said, you've got to revise the school finance formula. And the state legislature said, great, okay, we will. And then they could tell their voters who were unhappy, we had to. Well, you can imagine the same thing happening in the context of preschool. Last point. I think courts are going to be more effective at guaranteeing a right of access than guaranteeing quality. Quality is no doubt important, but if you look at what courts have done in the school finance context, it doesn't give you a great deal of confidence that courts are great at monitoring quality. So I think it's wrong to believe that courts can snap their fingers and create high-quality preschools. What I think they can be effective at is guaranteeing a baseline of access. But then you're going to have to rely on the political process to guarantee quality. But I think there are reasons to be optimistic that once the baseline is established, the politics will work as such to ensure that there is quality. Enough so that at the end of the day, I do think that in this context, courts can indeed play a fairly productive role as one part of a larger politically based effort to increase access to high quality preschools. All right. I'm sorry, I'm not leaving much time for questions, but thank you.